I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. This hour of the program, we're going to spend a good chunk of the time talking about community policing here in Milwaukee. We had Chief Edward Flynn scheduled for a show in August, and then Sherman Park happened, and of course he was pretty busy with all of that and continues to be. But he is with us for half of our show this morning, and we're also going to be speaking on our program with a gentleman who is now back on the beat in the 5th District. He's on patrol, but for quite some time he was community liaison officer for the 2nd Police District on the city of Milwaukee's near south side. He was born in Mexico and he is bilingual, and we'll talk about being an officer and a liaison in a part of the community where a lot of people speak Spanish and talk about the whole concept of community policing. So later, Officer Jesus Gloria will be joining us. All hour, you are welcome to join the conversation. Chief Flynn joining us first, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Chief Flynn was appointed chief of the Milwaukee Police Department in January of 2008. He commands an agency of 2,000 sworn officers and 700 civilians. Formerly police chief in Springfield, Massachusetts. He was Secretary of Public Safety under Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, Chief of Police in Arlington, Virginia, and he began his career with the Jersey City Police Department. He's a member of the Harvard Kennedy School's Executive Session on Policing and has a lot of other accomplishments as well. Chief Flynn, always good to see you. Hello. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Let's start with the news of this morning. The Milwaukee police officer who on August 13 fatally shot Savelle Smith was bound over for trial on sexual assault and prostitution charges. Dominique Hegan Brown was charged on 2 counts of felony second-degree sexual assault, 2 counts of prostitution, a misdemeanor, also a felony count of possessing or distributing a recording of nudity without consent. He was wearing a suicide prevention vest in court. He is in custody on a $100,000 bail. And I'm wondering whether or not this delays and does it complicate the release of the body cam that he was wearing on August 13th?
I would say there are two unrelated issues. The allegations that the police department accepted, investigated, and brought a case to the DA about aren't connected in any direct or indirect way with the shooting. The shooting investigation is a separate investigation, of course, that was conducted by the State Department of Criminal Investigation, and its findings have been turned over to the Milwaukee County District Attorney. So when his evaluation is complete and he's made his findings reference the shooting, that information will be made available.
And why does it take so long? A lot of people are saying that should have been released a long time ago. It's a couple months now since this shooting. Does it take a long time to do an investigation?
Investigations, by their nature, take a long time because there's physical evidence to process and await the return of. There are witnesses to be interviewed, and there is a wealth of material to be examined. I mean, every time there's a critical incident, people immediately want to see whatever video there is. And investigators have to keep in mind a couple of key issues regarding these videos. And one is that they're evidentiary. And one thing you don't want to do, I think if anybody learned anything about the initial Rodney King investigations in L.A., they realized that the airways had been so saturated by the videotaped beating of Mr. King that by the time a jury convened in Simi Valley, California, the public was inured to it. It was no longer had any shocking impact on the jury, and the jury was persuaded by a frame-by-frame analysis to, in fact, rule in favor of the defendant officers. I think there's something to be said for the fact that all material ends up being in public hands eventually. The question is, what is the urgency about getting it out there immediately? The thing about videotaped evidence, generally speaking, is that it doesn't always answer all questions. And in the environment we're living in right now, both politically and socially, people see tapes through the lenses of their preconceptions. People see what they want to see. And the other fact is that, what a video looks like in real time versus what it looks like in a frame-by-frame analysis are also two different things. Keeping in mind that the officer is acting in real time, and you can analyze it in the longest amount of time you want. You can do a frame-by-frame evaluation of every apparent decision an officer made, when in fact the officer made that decision literally in 5 or 6 seconds. And I just counsel folks that, although I'm generally sensitive about how serious sports analogies seem to be, I think it is relevant the number of times instant replays in the NFL don't answer the question. Somebody challenges the play or the ruling on the field, and everybody huddles around the camera or waits for the booth from New York, and the ruling is there's not enough information to overrule the ruling on the field. So it's not a cure-all. It's helpful. It's a piece of evidence, and sometimes it inflames more than it enlightens, and this is a deliberative process.
Moving into community policing and how effective it may have been since August 13th and the riots that subsequently followed in Sherman Park, that area has been pretty quiet. I know a lot of people who live in the community, and there's been great amount of discussion and community groups coming together. And as you said, the police had already formed relationships with some 70 community organizations, so you were able to, instead of just picking up the phone and calling people and saying, let's talk about this, you had relationships built with those organizations. What has been the aftermath of conversations and actions that have taken place since the riots in Sherman Park? It's been, thankfully, pretty quiet.
Well, a couple of things need to be kept in mind. Number one, the riot happened to Sherman Park. It wasn't of Sherman Park. Mm-hmm. We didn't arrest anybody who lived in Sherman Park. The people that were throwing pieces of concrete at the police officers were people who were criminally involved and were often associates of the decedent. Keep in mind that the BP station that was burned to the ground, it was owned by Sikh immigrants who were in a conflict situation with a number of people who'd been shoplifting and robbing the store. They'd had a confrontation a couple of weeks earlier where one of them fired shots in the air. Obviously, that was wrong over a shoplifting incident, but there was stress between the owner and those folks who were using it, and this riot was used as an opportunity to have revenge against him. ATF is investigating that case, and I'm suspecting that they may get themselves to the place where they'll be able to develop some suspects. So a lot of this violence was opportunistic, which all too often happens in these conflagrations. It's overwhelmingly opportunistic theft and criminality by the criminally involved. You know, everybody who was arrested in Baltimore had significant prior criminal records. It wasn't a protest. The biggest target of theft in Baltimore was OxyContin. It totally depressed the opioid market and resulted in a drug war in which Baltimore has been setting near record numbers of homicides since their riot, as people fight over turf over a depressed drug market because they flooded it with a prescription drug. So these things are a lot more complicated than CNN will ever have you believe. The only thing you know when the national media comes to town is they're going to get it badly wrong, but broadcast it all around the world. We don't mitigate through rhetoric any of the seriousness of what occurred, but we do think that the Christian Science Monitor got it right when the second day after the riot, they had a headline story, What Milwaukee Got Right. Despite over 500 shots being fired at the police, we didn't have a single use of deadly force by the officers during that event. We didn't fire a single round. We were inordinately restrained in handling the crowd situation. And as you indicated moments ago, we had pre-existing relationships with credible community partners that we were able to ask, and they stepped up as good citizens to go out on the streets and calm the waters and talk to the young people that were milling about in public spaces waiting for something to happen or something to do. So we went from a major conflagration on a Saturday night to some opportunistic vandalism and a few arrests on Sunday night to, by Monday night, nobody was getting arrested and there wasn't any law breaking. And by Tuesday, you know, victory in this world is CNN and Fox leaving town. And they did, because they were bored. They didn't have anything, you know, exciting, or nothing new was burned. So the community conversations afterwards, I think, are gradually getting more sophisticated, because I think it took a while for people to realize this wasn't about Sherman Park. Sherman Park is an integrated middle-class neighborhood. It is the American dream of what we want things to look like. And the fact that this gas station had to be located there had nothing to do with the people there. You know, an officer saw what he thought was something suspicious, investigated it. It was suspicious because Sherman Park is not a violent place. All right. And so the encounter that, you know, occurred after that interaction obviously is a subject of the investigation. But, you know, police are attentive to that area because it borders some high crime areas, and a number of individuals from those areas tried to perpetrate offenses upon Sherman Park.
Did you leave that experience thinking that you needed a lot more police?
Well, the police department is, you know, I've never made the number of police officers we have an excuse for anything we can do or can't do. But the fact is, my frustration has been this notion that Milwaukee's not doing enough on the side in the field of criminal justice, and that somehow we are a burden to the state with our crime issues. And some lame-brame legislature out there in the suburbs was, you know, proposing cutting our shared revenue because we are exporting crimes to these bucolic precincts that apparently she's responsible for. Fact of the matter is that Milwaukee sends more money to the state than it gets back. There's a $220 million gap between what the city collects in sales taxes and sends to the state and what they give to us. That's the police budget right there, that gap. You leave it alone, we can pay for everything and we don't need you. Problem I've stated over and over again is only the city is pulling its weight. Only the city. County's not pulling its weight financially. State certainly, by a country mile, is not pulling its weight financially when it comes to the issues concerning criminal justice. The police department right now is stressed. Although our authorized strength is approximately 1,900 and change, you know, rounded up to 2,000, the fact is we're not there now, and we're hitting a large number of retirements. We had a number this year. We're projecting possibly up to 300 retirements next year. People could retire. It's enormous stress on the organization and on our capacity to be both problem-oriented and community-based and data-driven. We have to balance that stress of real community engagement, community policing, community partnerships with the fact that we've got one of the highest, you know, homicide and non-fatal shooting rates in the country. Our homicide and non-fatal shooting rates are higher than Chicago's. We seize guns off the streets from criminals at a higher rate than Chicago. There was an article in the New York Daily News today. New York City, with 9 million residents, the PD just seized its 1,000th gun of the year. Okay? Milwaukee has already taken 2,100 guns from criminals off our streets, 600,000. Okay? They're more than 12 times our size. So it tells you about the nature of our challenge right now and the backdrop against which we put people in high-hazard locations and high-crime neighborhoods in an effort to both stabilize them through partnerships and leadership development and block watches, but also we've got to get out there and mix it up with bad guys because we've got a lot of them, and they're overwhelmingly victimizing their neighbors.
Mm-hmm. You also have talked about what it is that, you know, instead of marching on the streets to protest police, that people ought to be marching on the streets to protest the lack of funds, the lack of attention being paid to schools, to poverty, to drugs, to bullying, to all of that. Why do we continue to ignore all of those significant issues that really do lead to criminal behavior at times?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, I've been in this business for a very long time. I've been in this movie before. My career started in the 70s, you know. The frustrating thing for me and for many police chief executives and all the way down to those young idealistic men and women we you know, put on the streets of our most dangerous and heavily armed neighborhoods is the following. It's a good thing that people are mobilizing to articulate demands for justice. But to single out the police component of this and make it the straw man for all the failings of the criminal justice system specifically and American society generally borders on the hypocritical. And when I went to that town hall meeting with the president last August, they asked me to ask the last question, which they knew what it would be. And I said to the president, I said, every one of us, you know, believe and understand the importance of an accountable, ethical police institution, you know, in a free society. We recognize that as the only department of government authorized to use force to enforce its will, we've got to be accountable, accessible, fair, and impartial. But you cannot judge or understand policing separate and apart from the mission you've given it. Our officers are policing the most heavily armed, violent society in all of the industrialized world, Asian or European. No one else comes close. And the fact is that the greatest challenge to poor people of color in disadvantaged neighborhoods is violent death. All right, in Milwaukee, if you're an African-American, you are, I think the last time we looked, 18 times more likely to get shot than a white person. 18 times. Now, that has a devastating impact on the economy, on employment, on investment, and on opportunity. And my point is, I'd love to see thousands of people on the streets combining the conversations. I'm not saying stop complaining about bad policing. By all means, but address the entire, you know, component of the problem we're facing, which is an interlocking, you know, network of social failures for mental health and education and housing and employment and failures of the criminal justice system to hold individuals accountable. Knit it all together. Let's have the one big conversation. Stop pretending we can disaggregate this. And I think there's two components of cynicism that bother me. One, for the mass media, television particularly, conflict sells, crime sells. Let's focus on the conflict between the police and the community, and let's focus on violent crime. For politicians, it's cheap grace, okay? What politician are you going to see say, well, here, we have to seriously look at the housing stock on the north side of Milwaukee right now because so many of these houses are run by slumlords that are disasters and we need to coherent programs because they take several million dollars to implement. Okay, who's going to talk about that? Who's going to talk about what we really need in terms of enhanced funding for our public schools, given the disadvantaged circumstances of the students that they are charged with educating? You know, what about mental health services that are non-existent? And mental health is overrepresented in poor communities of color, and the police department becomes the mental health workers of first resort. Same thing with the opioid crisis. Same thing with the drug crisis. We've got massive holes in the social safety network that it's a lot easier to ignore. So for the right wing, it's about guns, and for the left wing, it's about the police. Neither one of those ideological constructs is going to reduce the amounts of deadly violence that are holding these neighborhoods back from realizing their potential.
We go to phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn is with us the first half hour of the program, and then we'll concentrate completely on community policing the second half hour of the show. 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Sabrina in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Sabrina?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. I'm from Milwaukee, and I moved a long time ago, but I have a lot of friends and family that live everywhere in Milwaukee, the north side, south side, east side, and people are mad, and people are angry, and people have a lot of hatred towards police officers, and it's more or less, in my opinion, drawn from media and mass media. And when certain situations happen with a police officer and a victim, and that victim ends up dead, it is an anger. It brings an outrage in the community, and that's what we saw with the Smith family. But what are some positive outlets that these people can resort to instead of being angry and resort to gun violence? One of my biggest things that I wanted to achieve in life is to create an outlet, a safe haven for people in gang violence and drugs and anything like that, a place for them to go so that they can be safe. And a lot of people have mental issues and have no stability and no family and nowhere to go, and they fall through the system by going to jail and going to prison. So I guess my question are, what are some ways that these people can get the help they need instead of resorting to all this anger?
Thanks, Sabrina, for your call.
Well, there's no question about it that we've got a subset of individuals in our disadvantaged neighborhoods for whom violence is seen as a solution for a wide variety of problems. I mean, you know, so far this year, 80% of our homicide victims are African American, and their victims, their suspects are described the same way. 84% of our described suspects are African American. It's highly concentrated, and when we disaggregate deadly violence in this city, we find that overwhelmingly it's perpetrated by and inflicted upon people with significant criminal records. So there's a subset. It's not the community. You know, it's not thousands of people involved in this thing. In any given time, it's a few hundred highly involved individuals who are highly involved in the criminal justice system, who are doing carjackings, robberies, and assorted other crimes encounter each other in some sort of social context, get in a fight, and somebody's dead, is the number one cause of violent death and shootings. We have innocent children murdered in crossfires. We have, you know, individuals killed in robberies, obviously. But last year, I had more people killed in car crashes by people driving stolen cars than I did by robbers. And the system refuses to look at stolen cars as anything but a mere property crime. And it's gone up more than 50% in just the last 2 years. Our offenders are learning the wrong message. The challenge here is the following. Too many people oversimplify disadvantaged neighborhoods as resorting to crime because of social conditions. And what I say is the overwhelming percentage of poor people living in disadvantaged neighborhoods, their only involvement in the criminal justice system is as crime victims. So stop generalizing that crime and poverty are the same thing. No, there's a subset of people coming from disadvantaged communities whose crimes are in public spaces. And the way I try to get people to understand it so we don't confuse drug crimes with violent crime is the following. Every scientific study there is out there indicates that people at all levels of society, all social classes, all racial and ethnic groups want to get high at the same rate on something or other. Okay? And I dare say theologians will tell you that all social classes and racial and ethnic groups sin at the same rates. But public space violence belongs to the poor. That's where it's going to be located. People who are oriented towards crime and are poor are going to do it with a gun in a public space. Okay? Somebody who comes from a better background is going to do it with a business degree working in a bank in the real estate subprime market. Okay? Same antisocial behavior. So stop generalizing about poor folks turning to crime as some sort of social protest. No, they're law-abiding. They're being victimized, and then they're being re-victimized because right now the cheap graces attack the police's efforts to try to do something to lower that victimization and back them up. People are trying to back up the police from protecting people. The overwhelming majority of 911 calls, disadvantaged communities. The overwhelming number of calls about disorderly groups come from those same neighborhoods. They want us to do something about disorder. The overwhelming percentage of calls for I've been victimized by a crime, those neighborhoods. That's our moral obligation. We need to do it fairly, impartially, with evidence-based practices, and in partnership with the community. But we've got to do it. And if you listen to some commentary right now, the only purpose of the police is not to give offense. And I'm saying that's not the way to save lives.
It must be, considering the number of guns in this society, which I've never fully understood, but it must be harder and harder to be a police officer encountering people, and you don't know whether or not they have guns and what kind of guns they have and whether or not they're willing to use them, which more and more people seem to be using. How important a component is this in keeping people alive?
Well, it's extremely important. And, you know, one of our frustrations is that, you know, we recognize the concerns about the so-called mass incarceration movement. All right. But let's get behind the numbers. So one thing to say, there are disparate rates of incarceration for, quote, mere drug possession. Now, my experience in Massachusetts when the Department of Correction was part of my bailiwick in public safety is those people that were in prison for, quote, drug possession cases overwhelmingly had pleaded to a drug case instead of the violent crimes associated with the drug case. That was the deal. That was the research I asked to be done because I kept hearing about, I mean, my experience was drug possession guys don't go to prison. They never go to prison. They don't even go to jail. But when we dug into it, we find, well, there's something behind the numbers. And what I urge people to understand is that sometimes when you identify a disparity, it really means, whoa, this is a disparity that can't be explained. But when you first identify the disparity, you've got to try to figure out, well, what is it related to? Okay? When 80% of my homicide victims are African Americans and so are their suspects, I'm going to have a disparity on who we arrest and send to prison for homicide. The non-fatal shooting numbers are almost identical to the homicide numbers. The ag assault numbers are even higher. The disparities in offending and victimization in disadvantaged communities blow away all other associated ethnic and racial groupings. So you're going to see disparity there. But if we're just going to look at the disparity numbers and assume we're up to no good, then we're denying justice to the surviving families of the vast majority of our homicides. That nuance in the conversation seems to have blown up as we obsess over gross demographic issues rather than drilling down as to what what failures are exposed by that that high rate of offending and victimization? What other issues are there that need to be addressed?
Well, what is the issue with guns? Why do so many people feel they have to have a gun?
Well, right now, I mean, look at our state. We've got some of the weakest gun laws in the country, particularly in terms of sentencing. Now, again, you know, a lot of well-meaning politicians are leery of mandatory sentences having to do with carrying guns because they see it's going to have a disparate impact on poor communities of color. You know, the challenge is the following. You know, there are certain conducts you can't affect with sentencing. Like I say, everybody wants to get high. That's harder to do by demonizing drugs or alcohol back in the 20s. But gun carrying is a rational act. You either think you need it for defense mm-hmm. or you're going to do it to do something to somebody. We have asked for mandatory sentences for illegal gun possession in this state because people need to feel that it's more dangerous to get caught with the gun than without it. But right now, the mental calculation of a career criminal is it's more dangerous for me not to have a gun. Okay? As long as they know they get caught with the gun, they're going to be out on bail the same day. And they know there's a good chance if the car's under the front seat instead of in their pocket, they'll beat the rap. Okay? But if they don't have their gun, when they meet mug the guy who's in the rival gang, they might get shot.
Right.
So that is a rational act. And we're not doing anything in the legislature to deal with that rational component. New York City is down to 1,000 guns because 20 years ago, they significantly toughened the sanctions for illegal gun carrying. And you know what the nice thing is about it? Their mass incarceration issue is no longer an issue because guys stopped carrying guns, which meant they stopped shooting each other, which meant they weren't going to jail for murder and manslaughter raps or aggravated assault raps because they didn't have the gun. So their crime went down and the number of people carrying guns went down and the incarceration rate in New York City has gone down. We got to think beyond the easy analysis. And right now we're letting easy, lazy analysis and stories drive policy. And if your policy is formulated by stories rather than thoughtful data analysis, you end up with bad policy. And that's where we are now.
Yeah. Chief Flynn, thank you very much. We're going to let you go back to the office.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much. Chief Edward Flynn, our guest, the first part of this hour. We're going to talk about community policing as we continue our discussion here today. And we have a new guest with us. And he is Officer Jesus Gloria. He was for quite some time the community liaison officer for the 2nd Police District on the City of Milwaukee's Near South Side, named Community Liaison Officer of the Year by the Milwaukee Police Department during its annual Crime Prevention Awards ceremony. He's now on patrol in the 5th District. He'll describe where that is. And he is the first truly bilingual a community police liaison officer. He was born in Mexico and moved to the U.S. as a teen. He also has worked as a court interpreter for the Kenosha County Courts and joined MPD in 2004. We'll speak with him in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Officer Gloria, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi. Yes, good morning.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. So you're back on the street. You're not community liaison officer anymore.
That's correct.
Because you're going to move up in the ranks or what?
I'm trying.
I see.
Yes.
And you found that being on the street, you had to
so
do that again.
I took the sergeant's test, and that's when you realized, wow, I need to get back on the street before I can lead the officers. So it's a total different role, but I'm back. Mm-hmm. I'm back learning the ropes and back on the street.
Yeah. Let's talk about the time as community liaison officer, mm-hmm. because when we talk about community policing, it seems to me to be a perfect example of what community policing is. What was your role there, and how important was it to have a bilingual speaker, maybe even from Mexico, as some people are on the Near South Side,
correct,
communicating with various groups and with people in the neighborhood?
Well, as the first community liaison officer, what can I say? It's an honor. It was my duties were to, it's more crime prevention, looking into the relationship with the community, getting to know the neighbors, getting to know the business owners, their workers. And that comes with needs. I mean, there's a different culture. It's a total different culture, total different experiences that they had in Mexico. So when they come to this country, they're a little bit afraid of the police. Mm. And when you have a bilingual officer, that makes it easier. They trust you. You are just like them. So I don't want to say that that's what we need to do for every culture or every, you know, different race, but it made things easier for us.
Mm-hmm. So you would talk to people in businesses, you met with school groups, you met just...
Senior centers, schools, churches, you name it, I was there. Mm-hmm. So it is beautiful. It's a nice experience. I did it for 10 years.
Oh my goodness.
So yes, so I was involved. I've been with the department for 12 and a half years. And out of the 12 and a half, 10 years, I was assigned with the community. Mm-hmm. So building block watches, going to schools, the bullying, kids, they look up to you. And then our community is, more than anything, empowering them. So the mission statement of the police department talks about that in partnership with the community, which we forget. It is, in partnership with the community, we will create and maintain neighborhoods capable of sustaining civic life. And we forget that. We forget that it's not just the police, it's not just the officers, it's in partnership. We have, our police department offers monthly meetings. And we don't even go to those monthly meetings. So my job was to convey those messages to our community, to go where the officers don't go. Most of the time, we are responding to calls
right. As
an officer. So I would say we're like a pizza place, like a pizza. If you don't order it, you don't get it. So when you call the police, you get the police. So I always tell the neighbors, if you're not sure how the protocols work, if you don't know how to call, what to do, come to the monthly meetings. Our chief has monthly meetings for everyone. You can come and meet the police captains. And the captains, I mean, we have your aldermen, you have your Department of Neighborhood Services, Department of Public Works, your county supervisors, you have the community organizers, you have everybody there. Everyone is at those meetings, and it's beautiful. And when you come with a need, hey, I'm having an issue. We've been having this kind of problems. Well, I'm there. I mean, your community liaisons are there. So, hey, do you have a block watch? Well, what's that? So then you begin to build things. I mean, what are the numbers that we call the police? So you come to those meetings, and you learn everything about that. They remind you, you know, the only two numbers to call for police is 911 for life or death. The non-emergency, the 933-4444, and go directly to extension number 9 when you need a squad to respond. It's not a life or death, but you need a squad to respond. Somebody broke into your house, into your vehicle, or you need to report suspicious activity. Mm-hmm. And those are the only numbers to call. So when you begin to get involved, you learn things that, wow, I didn't even know. I mean, the captains, they present to you the crimes that have been happening in the last month. This is how many burglaries we had, robberies. And many of the neighbors are like, Officer Gloria, you have no idea. I mean, I feel like now I'm beginning to see things.
Right.
I never saw that. I didn't know about it. We have to do the block watch. I need you to come here and help me. We need to do a neighborhood cleanup. Mm-hmm. We have to get the kids involved. But they don't respect me. They don't like me. I mean, Officer Gloria, can you help me with this? So that's where we come in. So then we go talk to the kids. I mean, sometimes we think that the parents tend to scare the kids. I'm going to call the police and they're going to get you a ticket. You're going to get arrested. I mean, and it's like, no, hold on. I'm a service to them. Don't scare them. Mm-hmm. I always tell the kids, don't ever run to the, from the police. Don't ever lie to the police. And we're your friends. So don't ever be afraid of us. Never. Three things. Never be afraid of us. Never run from us and never lie to us. And some of the officers even said, hey, Officer Gloria, we responded to this call. And I think the mom said something that wasn't supposed to. And the kid's like, Mom, don't lie. Remember? I mean, it's funny. It's like, Officer Gloria, like they always say, like, everybody knows you. But that's what we do as community liaison officers, is try to get to know the community. It's almost like they're my family. It's more friends. Everybody. I love mm-hmm. everybody. Mm-hmm. Everyone. I mean, I don't know. It was an honor to serve in that capacity. It's beautiful.
I can tell.
Yes, it was so nice. It was different. Mm-hmm. It was different. It was motivating our community, empowering them, and at the same time, you're serving in a different capacity. and you're helping them. So somehow we bring two worlds together, mm-hmm. and then we find answers. So it's beautiful. I mean, it works.
You talk about block watches, and I know that they can be incredibly effective. Why aren't they all over this city, and why is it that people, because they make a difference, to be on the lookout, to say nothing of the fact that it's a more neighborly, friendly place to live if you have a block watch. You're on the lookout for your neighbor, and you have a sense if there's something going on, you need to be on the lookout. Why aren't there a whole bunch of them?
What happens is you get involved. And the problem goes away. And we are busy. It's just the nature. We're working. We have kids, school. We are just busy people. Mm-hmm. And when you have your block watch in progress, the problem goes away. Then you stop getting involved. So then pretty soon we don't have a block watch. Then we forget about it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like, it's like a cycle. We have to keep reminding people. We have to make people accountable. We have to make our police department accountable. We have to make our representatives accountable. So, but we have to work together. It's so with the block watch, I mean, we have block watch. I always say that most of the people in our community are beautiful people, are awesome people, they care. They mean well. And it's just a few rotten apples that we together need to find out who they are and find a solution. I mean, it's not giving them a citation, getting them arrested. Sometimes it's just giving them a visit and reminding them, hey, what you're doing, I mean, we're watching. Mm-hmm. So knock it off. Stop mm-hmm. that. Get back to playing basketball. Whatever happened with that? I mean, you were good at soccer. I mean, what else do you like? I mean, music. So then, well, I mean, so-and-so, I mean, my new friends. I mean, I don't know. They just... So with the block... I mean, block watch is so important and is... And it's more important because it's a easy way to protect your things. I mean, we work so hard to have our vehicles, to have, you know, your house, right. your things. And then for someone to come and just burglarize and through the block watch, you are, I don't know, everyone is watching. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, you don't have to get involved in this. All you have to do is call for police. We will get involved. You know, just call us, call the police. But what numbers? Again, we go back. What are the numbers that we need to call? So we have potholes on the street. It's not just the police. There's potholes.
Yes,
there's like
we do.
Garbage. There's like graffiti, your trees. I mean, the lights, things like that. Stop signs. I mean, broken. And are we reporting this to the Department of Public Service? I mean, or Public Works? DNS. I mean, we have a neighbor that doesn't cut the grass or doesn't care or looks, his house looks like maybe we need to get involved. As a mm-hmm. block watch, maybe we can go and help him. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, we need to talk to our neighbors somehow, right. But I don't know. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And do you see this as something that's, I know you did this until recently and for a number of years on the Near South Side. Is this happening in communities all over the city that we have positions like this where officers are really intimately tied to the community?
Yes.
We do.
Every district, we have our city of Milwaukee is divided in seven pieces. And each piece, we call it a district. So you have the aldermanic districts, of course, in which everyone thinks is the same thing. But our police department has seven districts. Each district, we have a police station. So we have seven police stations. We have our police captains assigned to every district. Every district is divided in four areas. So you have officers assigned to those areas, and we are there. I mean, we're there 24/7. We're never, I don't know, it's just like I never call sick. You know, we're never calling in. We're always there. We're always working. We're always ready for the next call. We're ready to help people. We're ready to, you know, just always observing and looking for trouble. What's mm-hmm. out of place? How can we, looking for solutions? And I don't know. We just need to get the community involved. So,
yeah. Why did you decide to become a police officer?
My dad had friends, growing up in Mexico, my dad had friends who were police officers, and I always look up to them. And mm-hmm. it was always like, they're always like looking so clean, look sharp, strong. People like them, love them. And I always thought, I want to be like that. I always thought, I just want to be a police officer. I actually wanted to be, what do you call them, federales?
Huh?
Like a state trooper.
Right.
So, but then things changed. I mean, when I came to the United States and the opportunity came, and at the time, my wife, my girlfriend, asked me, like, what do you want to be? What are you going to go to college for? But it's like, you know, I'm not sure. She's like, what do you mean? I was like, I'm not sure. So with my English as a second language, you know, English as a second language, it was a little harder. But it's like, what did you want to be when you were little? Focus on that. Don't worry about the rest. Things come together. You will get better at things. And just do it. So I was like, you know, I always wanted to be a police officer. It's like, there's your answer.
There it is.
Go for it. Do it. So I did it. Mm. And here I am now.
Isn't it a scary job?
It is a scary, but how can I say? God is with me all the time. Mm. So I'm not afraid for that reason. Always trusting in God. So
we're going to welcome phone calls for you. We're talking about community policing, this part of the program. And our guest is Officer Jesus Gloria. For 10 years, was the community liaison officer for the 2nd Police District on the city of Milwaukee South Side. He is now with the 5th District and is now on patrol. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd love to hear from you about this concept of community policing and the relationship between communities and the police. Karen writes to us on Facebook that Officer Gloria was the best community officer in the district. I guess you were beloved.
Oh,
that's
thanks.
A nice way it to is. Start interacting, isn't it? Nice. We go to Chris in Rome, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Love your show.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to give a quick shout out. I doubt he's still on the police force anymore, but I remember when I was a child growing up on the south side of Milwaukee, we had a bike officer by the name of Officer Matthews, and he had a huge impact on my friends and I growing up because he would always stop and take time to talk to us, ask us how school was going, give us the baseball cards.
Yeah.
So it was a really positive impact, and it kind of shaped the way that all of my friends and I viewed the police officers for the rest of our lives.
Oh, that says a whole lot, yes. Chris, doesn't it? Officer, that's quite a comment.
That is really nice, and that is so true. I mean, and that's where the beat officers, you have your community liaison officers. Now we have our school officers. So we have plenty of those officers, and again, yes, that is so true. They're the ones that make a big difference in kids' life.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was an everyday thing with us. So,
yeah, thank
so
you.
Thank
you, Chris, so much for your call. Tony in Egg Harbor. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Kathleen. I had a personal experience 20 years ago. I arranged a Christmas party for the Chicago Police Department on the first Saturday of every December. So in every police district lobby, we arranged a tree-trimming party at 10 a.m., and the local kids came to decorate a tree in the Christmas for Christmas in the police station. And at one of the parties, a newspaper interviewed this little Hispanic girl, and they said, what do you like about coming here? And words had never been so profoundly spoken. She had said, before today I was afraid of the police, and now I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And this girl's probably in her 30s by now, and it really just struck me that the image of police, from the cars that they drive to the uniforms that they wear, they're so stealth-looking that we're raising a generation of kids that are forever going to be afraid of the police just by the way they look, and the LED lights that they have now are even more intimidating. Why is it that police need to maintain this foreboding image?
Mm. Thank you so much, Tony, for your call. Officer Gloria.
That's a good question. I mean, when you look, you have right there two worlds, and I guess that's where the parents come in, and we can explain to our kids. If you think about ourselves, I mean, what is the role of the police department? I mean, to protect, to serve, and to fight crime. So, and we're the first responders, and when we're responding and the lights, I mean, it's so hard for traffic, people with loud music, windows closed, and everybody's on the phone. I mean, people are busy, and we're responding to an emergency. So people don't see you. I mean, to prevent crimes, to avoid this kind of stuff, that's why the lights come better. And then in fights, I mean, groups, you can, from far away, you see the police. So we need the police presence. We need to just, the fact that you're present, I mean, people slow down, people behave. And that's what we want. I mean, I guess, what will be your idea about this? I mean, I guess we are a service to you.
Mm. What do you think, Tony?
Well, I understand that they have to maintain this image to scare the bad guys, but I think it's having a counterproductive effect because they're scaring the good guys much more than they're scaring the bad guys, because the bad guys aren't as easily scared. And I think that the whole image of what happened in Ferguson, what happened in Florida, what's happened in Chicago, that they're scaring the good guys into this us against them or them against us. It's just not working. Their firefighters don't have this issue because they're there to save you from the enemy, which is the fire. The police are there to save us from ourselves. And the whole paradigm is upside down. It needs to be reversed, because if they continue like this, we're going to become some Blade Runner society, and we're all going to be running in fear, and this is not working.
Mm. Time to go trim the trees in the local precincts, I think. Thank you, Tony, very much for the call. I meant to get to the chief on this, and I don't know if you can answer this, if it's a policy statement, but I'm wondering about the ACLU wrote a piece recently talking about the Milwaukee Police Department in regards to community policing, saying that they do have a large presence in neighborhoods afflicted by high crime, but that there are a number of officer-initiated stops per year, 200,000 was the ACLU numbers, often not made for the reason given, and potentially abuse the use of consent searches. Are the, it, what about a policy? You don't want to answer. Yeah, that would come from higher up. Yeah, and that may be a part of what Tony's talking about too.
Correct.
But to get back to the idea about people in the community making their concerns known and working collaboratively with police, if that's something that they're concerned about in the community, those meetings that you talk to, I think that you're absolutely right that
yes. If
people can carve the time once a month to go and meet in community and address those kinds of concerns and also know what's going on,
yes. That
it's something that we should all do, really.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we are a service to you, and the reality is the majority of our community has no idea of what the non-emergency is, or who your alderman is,
or who
are they? I mean, we don't even know our officers. So get to know your officers. Come to the meetings. Come out there. Wave at the officers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, things like that. Whenever you see them, I mean, I don't know why. I'm not afraid of the police. I love to see the officers.
Every time I go, the police officer.
I go to the grocery store. I mean, you go to the grocery store. I go to the mall, and I see officers. It's beautiful.
Right.
I love it.
Yes.
Because it's a different sense. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
more, it's safe. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not working. I want to be just like everybody else. Just
let's go to Kim in Waupun. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say to your guests and to all the officers out there, I really appreciate the work you do, and I thank you, because you guys are putting your lives on at risk to help us.
Yes.
And, yes, we do have some problem officers, but I do want to bring up something that I think that people are forgetting, that you guys are also dealing with PTSD.
Yes.
And because of the stuff that you see that we don't see,
mm-hmm.
and I think some of the officers with some of the conditions that have happened with the unarmed shootings and that, and it is sad because it hurts all of the community,
yes,
which is the country as a whole. Because when you see one officer or a couple officers in a different state, that affects all officers throughout the country. And there are really, really good officers out there.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sitting right across from one right now, no doubt about that.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I feel like the time was short, and I hope you'll come back and join us again to
talk
about your work.
Yes.
I think what you've done is just remarkable.
Yes. One thing that I just want to say to everyone is, if you don't have a Black Watch, contact your community liaison officer. Every district, everywhere where you live, every city has a police department. Go to your police department and ask for the crime prevention officer. Let him know that you're interested, and he will give you a package. He's going to work with you, and he's going to help you, but we have to do it together.
Absolutely.
Thanks, everyone.
Our guest officer, Jesus Gloria, he is now on the 5th District, now on patrol, was the community liaison officer for the 2nd Police District, City of Milwaukee, for 10 years. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to the chief for being with us, and thanks to Officer Gloria for being with us, for all your calls as well.